Welcome to CXO Talk, episode number 837. Today, we're exploring the technology behind AI and the implications for workforce transformation. Our guest is Kian Khatanfarooq, and he is co-creator of Stanford's deep learning course and CEO of a company called Workera.
In 2017, I co-created the deep learning class at Stanford with Andrew Ng, one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence. And together, we've taught AI and deep learning to over 4 million students, both on campus, but also online through an initiative we call deeplearning.ai. The goal at the time was to democratize access to AI education. And as all these students around the world were taking our classes and watching our videos, some of them pointed that with the emergence of content, they're drowning in an ocean where any skill can be learned into thousands of different ways. But one of the gaps that they pointed out they had was understanding their skills. What am I good at? What am I lacking? What benchmarks do I meet? Am I better than the average big tech engineer or the average product manager out there? And so in 2019, as we were getting this feedback, we created another company called Workera, which is a skills technology company that leverages AI to help organizations and individuals verify their skills, future-proof themselves. And it turns out that when you are more self-aware about your skills, you can make the right decisions. You may not need to do a 200-hour class when you can take a 10-hour class and 5 articles that directly focus on your gap.
When we hear terms like deep learning and like machine learning, what are we actually referring to?
The way you can think of AI is a large field of study focused on making machines capable of performing certain tasks that would typically be performed by humans. But AI can encompass anything from the most simplistic algorithms to the most advanced neural networks, if you will. Machine learning, on the other hand, is the subset of AI that focuses on developing algorithms that are learning, as the name suggests. They can perform tasks without being explicitly programmed for that task. And deep learning is even a smaller subset of machine learning, which focuses on algorithms that are broadly mimicking neurons as we know them in the human brain. The analogy is not super accurate, but you can think of it as neurons that ingest information and that end up learning certain things. And so if I give you an example to understand the three levels, when you're going to Google Maps and you're trying to go from point A to point B, AI in the background is optimizing the route from point A to point B. Now, imagine you want to add traffic in real time and take it into a consideration. Now your algorithm needs to adapt and the route may change on a day-to-day basis. And now we're in the realm of machine learning. If you now want to have an autonomous car that understands highly unstructured data, like images, like video streams, we call that perception algorithms or computer vision. Now you're talking deep learning. It's the family of algorithm that is the best suited for that type of problem.
Can you shed some light on how these technologies work? Because we know the terminology.
Imagine that you are trying to build a model that is meant to detect whether there is a cat or no cat on a given picture. Well, if I ask you to go on a whiteboard and write the formula that is meant to detect cat, will you be able to do it or not? There is no such formula. We don't understand the mathematical formula. So instead of writing a formula, I am going to program a function that is highly complex. The function is highly adaptable. It has parameters that can be fitted on data. And so instead of writing a formula, I am going to select a large enough data set of cat pictures and non-cat pictures, and I'm going to label them cat or non-cat. And I'm going to iteratively give maybe a picture at a time to the model and let the model predict whether there's a cat or no cat. And if the model is right, I'm going to give it a thumbs up and reinforce the fact that the function it is fitting is probably correct. If the model is wrong, instead, I'm going to ask the model to modify its parameters, to modify the function it is fitting. And it turns out that if you do that thousands of times, sometimes millions of times, you end up having learned the function detect cat. And the model can then use that function in real time on a new data set that it has never seen, and it will be able to detect a cat. And that's called the learning process.
Help folks listening to have a better understanding of under the covers when that cat recognition is taking place. How does it actually happen?
One of the things to know about machine learning is the differences between the training process, which I just described, and the prediction or the inference process, that is you using that cat detector for a specific purpose on a use case that can be an industrial use case or a business use case. So once you understood the training process that I've described, you now have a model that has parameters that have been fitted on a data set, and the model is ready to be used. You can now put a camera in your garden and upload, if you will, that model either on a cloud infrastructure if the camera is connected to the internet, or directly by putting a file of parameters and an architecture on the camera. And whenever a video stream or an image is captured by the camera, that image, which is essentially a set of pixels that can be described in computer science with numbers, is fed into the model. The model is going to process it. Remember the function I was talking about earlier. The image would make it to the function. The function will compute all, will calculate the function. The model will calculate the function we fit. In the end, you will receive a probability between 0 and 1, indicating whether the model thinks there is a cat or no cats in the image. And this is called the inference process, the prediction process from input to output.
So what are the implications of this for business people in terms of the applications, and how does this then relate to generative AI and the type of applications that are suitable for Gen AI and where problems arise, such as hallucinations, for example?
As a business leader, you're probably facing many use cases, and not everything will be solvable per AI. But the reason AI will matter is by understanding how artificial intelligence works or Gen AI works, you will understand how to develop a competitive advantage, maybe for your business or your organization. You will be better positioned to determine what strategic investments to make. So to go back to the example I was giving you with Google Maps, the first version I was describing that takes us on a map from point A to point B does not require meaningful data to be fed. It is, if you were to solve that problem, you would not have to think about the data that you collect. However, if you're building an autonomous car, you will need to have tons of data about roads and traffic signals and pedestrian. And so understanding the capabilities of AI, the learning process, will allow you as a business leader to determine what type of data you need to collect and whether that data can translate into a competitive moat for your organization. The other thing that I find helpful as a business practitioner is you probably will be asked to maybe hire an AI team or a data team. And without the knowledge of AI, you will struggle to determine who to hire or who to put on what projects. And so understanding the different specialties matter. And finally, we're in a world where different AI technologies might be subject to different regulatory concerns, privacy, transparency, explainability, and understanding those topics will really help you determine what to do.
As business leaders are looking at their workforce and the implications of AI, what are some of the key issues that they really need to be thinking about today?
There is a metric shared on a regular basis by the World Economic Forum called the half-life of skills that explains how long a skill might be helpful in someone's career. 40 years ago, the half-life of skill was above 10 years, meaning that you do not need as a worker to refresh your skills too frequently. Most recently, the World Economic Forum has shared that the half-life of skill is around 4 years. In digital fields like AI, it's probably even closer to 2 years. We are seeing the half-life of skills compress, which means that we constantly need to reinvent ourselves to learn new skills if we want to innovate. And so AI has pushed us to become skills-based organization. And when skills are moving so fast and you need to refresh your competencies so fast, being self-aware of your strength and your gaps becomes increasingly important because we don't have all the time of the world. We need to determine what classes we're going to take, what subject matter areas we're going to focus the next 10 hours of our learning on. And without knowing our capabilities, we are not able to make the right decisions, which is where a worker comes in to serve organizations to accelerate their learning.
The issue then is one of having a clear understanding of the skills that are present inside the organization and where the trajectory is going. Was that an accurate way of describing it?
Yeah. So I would say there's two steps. The first one is, where are we at? Let's benchmark ourselves with an adaptive test aligned with the business objective of the organization, because every business is slightly different. So the type of skills you will need is also slightly different. So the first question is, where are we at? The second question, as you measure over time, is how fast are we moving? And this is a metric that we call learning velocity, that we believe is a new competitive advantage for businesses. Making sure that you have a high learning velocity is essentially bulletproofing yourself against disruption to make sure that whenever there is a new innovation, a new language model, a new method that comes out in the market, you have a team that is able to learn it and apply it to your domain and produce a meaningful innovation.
I guess one of the challenges that business leaders face right now is understanding that trajectory, because AI is moving so quickly. And so how can business leaders deal with that issue of needing to assess and needing to understand where things are going and not knowing, really?
As a business leader, you are uniquely positioned to understand the capabilities you need in order to solve the projects that you have ahead of you, the OKRs that you're trying to meet, the sales that you're trying to make. And that is what's unique about business leaders. Over the last 10 years, business leaders have been asked to be doing all sorts of things that they're not meant to know. You know, most of us, business leaders, we were promoted because we had subject matter expertise in an area. We were not promoted most of the time because we were a great talent manager, because we had a PhD in psychometrics, the ability to measure skills in our team, because we're a learning scientist and understand what best content is out there for our team. That is not why you're promoted into that role. And so your job is not to go and screen the internet and find what is the best class for employee A or employee B. Your job is, can I translate meaningfully my projects and my OKRs into skills and then let a machine take care of the rest? And so what I anticipate will happen is business leaders that are able to surround themselves with a set of AI agents, maybe one agent that is expert at skills measurements, an agent that is expert at recruiting, an agent that is expert at learning science. By surrounding yourself with those systems, you will become a better talent manager. You will align learning with your business objectives, and then you will have your employees accelerate their transformation.
Subscribe to our newsletter and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We do have incredible shows coming up. What are the skills that business leaders really need to focus on at this point in time, especially as AI changes business and the type of skills evolve in response to AI?
I think we have to understand that everyone will be an AI person, just at different levels of proficiencies. So when I look at an organization, I see multiple groups some of us are builders of AI, and we are producing language models, we are developing AI systems. We are about 5% of an organization. Most of us are users of AI. We are interfacing with AI. Sometimes we are calling APIs and language models in order to solve certain problems. The builders of AI typically belong to a center of excellence. They need the top practitioner skills. The users of AI, I look at them in across three groups. The top one being what I call AI plus X, which are folks that have a specific subject matter area beyond computer science. They may be expert at a certain domain. In the class that I've been teaching since 2017 at Stanford, we're in a graduate course in computer science, but two-thirds of our students are not majoring in computer science, which is pretty incredible. They come from mechanical engineering, from electrical engineering, from material science, from business, law, and aeronautics and aerospace. And they are really good when boosted with AI skills. And so I invite business leaders to look at these AI plus X folks that you have internally and try to boost their capabilities with AI because they know their area and they will know what to do with it. Now, the other groups are the vast majority of the organization that would represent the fluency and the literacy group within AI. Fluency is a set of skills that is needed of usually desk workers, business practitioners that interface with an AI organization, with a software organization. Imagine an HR professional trying to support a data organization but doesn't understand what Python is or what TensorFlow is or what technologies are needed or is not conversant and not able to recruit the right folks. That is a gap. Imagine a marketing professional trying to market a new AI feature without understanding how to talk about AI. Imagine a sales professional or an account executive trying to pitch a data infrastructure product without understanding the concerns around data privacy, compliance, and so on. All of these fall under a fluency group. And then finally, the literacy group to me is a lot of frontline workers, a lot of deskless workers that are making up large parts of Fortune 500 companies and are in need to be part of the change as the company is transforming. Yeah.
We have a very interesting question from Twitter, and this is from Arsalan Khan, who says, why would an employee help an organization replace themselves with AI when their jobs are on the line? He goes on, reskilling is important, but most organizations would rather save money by laying off full-time people. And then what about the hidden AI costs that organizations don't know about yet? So bottom line, why should employees help reskill, help train AIs that will replace them?
There's multiple components involved in that question. The first one is a workforce planning question. Is do companies actually need to lay off, or can companies just do more with the same amount of people resources? The second question is around the employee themselves. Should employees be worried? Why would they help train AI if AI is going to replace them? And I don't think every employee is in need to train AI. I think most of us are not going to train AI. But to go back to the first question, we're now looking at the workforce and we're seeing a lot of productivity changes in the workforce. It turns out that productivity changes happening today are an indication of what the workforce will likely look like in 6 months from now, in a year from now, in 2 years from now. Let me give you a concrete example. If a task can now be done twice as fast or twice as more efficiently, it is likely that the number of person that are taking care of those tasks in an organization will be divided by two in terms of headcount. So all of these are important questions. When we look at tasks, we look at them across three levels of productivity enhancements. Many tasks fall under incremental gain, maybe 1 to 2x productivity enhancement. And those tasks are unlikely to change drastically with the emergence of AI systems. A lot of tasks are going to fall under the group of augmentation, probably 2 to 9x productivity enhancements. And those will be delegated to human plus AI. It will be a collaboration, most likely in the future. And then if you go beyond that mark, you're at 10 plus X productivity enhancement. And we are in the realm of automation. And I think the majority of automated use cases we're going to see this year is around customer operation. A lot of automation is going to come, and it's going to be one of the first things that society will see. Now, at the same time, when we look at jobs, we don't look at jobs standalone. We think of jobs as a set of tasks. So for instance, a job may require many, many tasks, 100 tasks. And each task is under one of these three levels. And so when you analyze a job and you see that 70% of its tasks fall under the automation realm, that job is likely gone. You're right. If a job, most jobs are not going to be in that category. There is estimates showing that about a third of the jobs in the workforce are falling under that category, which has a lot of automation, task automated, and will require some level of reskilling, career transition, etc. At the same time, there is a ton of job creations. I'll give you a few examples. People often forget that regulations create a ton of jobs. If you remember GDPR in Europe, GDPR actually created a ton of specialized jobs into those areas that required skills that nobody had at the time. So it was a huge reskilling effort, bringing people whose job may be gone in the near future up to speed in a new area that is highly needed in an organization. So the point I'm making is that I think there is going to be a ton of job creation. I think the demand for a job will continue to increase. Unemployment is relatively low in the United States, if you look at it. And what's going to make the difference is whether organizations are going to invest in their employees. And on that topic, Michael, if you don't mind me spending a 30 seconds or a minute, I anticipate that organizations will have a ton of movement internally. It is possible that there is less hiring, but I anticipate Fortune 500 organizations to double down on their workforce, to focus on upskilling. And the reason is simple. You have people that are aligned with your mission, that are aligned with your culture, that are aligned with your values, and that's really hard to find. So you are in a good place to help these people get up to speed with the skills that will make up the future of the organization rather than looking externally. The second aspect of it, and I'll give you an example from one of our customers at Workera. One of our customers works on turbines. They've been building turbines for a long time. It turns out that they have the world's foremost experts in turbines. Now AI is going to come in and change the way you build turbines. Who is going to be the best positioned to build that turbine of the future? That same person boosted with AI skill. Because if that company starts looking outside the organization for AI plus turbine experts, they will never find them. There's just no one in the world that will be able to carry out that project better than the person that is already on the job.
We often hear the phrase human in the loop to describe this collaboration between people and machines. We recently had as a guest on CXO Talk, Paul Daugherty, who is the Chief Technology and Innovation Officer at Accenture. And he used the phrase orchestration, that people will orchestrate a variety of AI tasks as opposed to being in the middle of every one. Any thoughts on that approach, that line of thought?
I think we've looked at the workforce as purely a human workforce up to now. That is going to change because of agents. It is likely that every human will have one, two, maybe more agents at their disposal and will need to a certain extent to orchestrate that workforce of agents that can allow them to be more productive. That is how I would look at it. Yeah.
What are the kind of key challenges that organizations face as they're looking at their workforce and going through this process of evaluation and then planning when it comes to AI skills?
The first challenge is developing a good skills vision. So, you know, if you think about it, do you know the skills that are going to be the most important to you 2 years from now? 3 years from now for yourself personally and your organization? It's a relatively hard question. That's the first part. The way I recommend to look at it is as a T-shape career framework. I think T-shape career frameworks are going to become more and more popular, and they're very popular within the Workera clientele. What I mean by T-shape is you have a horizontal skill set that is made of durable skills, skills that are useful on the long run, over 5 years. Many softer skills, called also character skills or power skills, fall under that category. But also hard skills like math, like statistics, like data analytics, like probabilities also fall under that category of durable skills that make up the horizontal bar of the T. On the other hand, you have a vertical bar of the T that are perishable skills. Those skills are tied to innovation. They are fast changing. They need to be refreshed on a constant basis. To innovate, you will need a mix of durable and perishable skills. It turns out that the perishable skills are directly tied to innovation, and the durable skills are the one that will allow you to gain new perishable skills. And so imagine that skills vision that an organization has set up, a worker has their T-shape and they're working toward it. The issue that we face secondary to that skill vision is that people don't understand the skills they have. On Workera, before taking an adaptive assessment, you are guessing your level of proficiency in a variety of domains. And what we see is that over 80% of folks are completely wrong about their level of proficiency. About half of them underestimate the skill sets they have. Imagine a mechanical engineer that is trying to adopt AI. Turns out they're really good at math and they're really good at linear algebra, and they actually can fast track their way toward adopting AI skills. On the other hand, some overestimate their skills and think that they are better than they are. And then we end up with a workforce of dangerous amateurs that are trying to build AI systems without being able to productize them properly, to monitor them effectively, and to make sure they're building responsibly. And so that's unknown is a real issue in the business. Only when you have the skill infrastructure allowing you to answer this question, what are we good at? What are we not good at? Then you can go and become a skills-based organization. You can start matching people to the right content that is more appropriate for their needs. You can start matching people to the right projects that are aligned with their skill set. You can start matching people to the right mentor internally that has a proficiency higher than them and that can pull them up. All of that is the third step of what business leaders care about, which is the execution of the skills-based organization.
You've got the durable skills and the perishable skills. How does the approach to measurement differ in between these two groups?
The main difference between measuring a durable versus a perishable skill is the frequency at which you need to modify the measurements and to tweak the skills that are involved. So for instance, on Workera, there is an assessment that is called Mathematics for AI. Well, that assessment has a half-life that is quite high, and we don't need to update it too frequently. The benefit of that is that there's so many people that take that assessment that there are so many benchmarks. So when you take it, you have a ton of statistics that tell you within Mathematics for AI, there are 100 skills and you have 55 of them and you're lacking 45 of them. And on average in your industry, this is where you stand. On the other hand, you have other assessments like prompt engineering, which are very popular at the moment. Prompt engineering is a fast-changing domain that has already been updated multiple times over the past 12 months by the Workera team and the experts, because you have the emergence of technologies like RAG, methods like chain of prompts. And those things need to be taken into account. The domain needs to be updated. You obviously will have less benchmarks and statistics and data because the domain is ever evolving, but you still be able to measure it in a very relevant manner.
So you're saying when it comes, for example, to prompt engineering, you're measuring skills. What elaborate on that, okay?
If you are a technical practitioner, you are in that group of builders of AI or technical users of AI that I was describing earlier, you belong to a center of excellence, your manager has determined that prompt engineering is an important skill for you to have. Prompt engineering is made up multiple granular skills. There are so many different layers within it to learn. You receive an assessment that is going to take you maybe 25 minutes. It is adaptive. It's going to ask you a question on prompt engineering. If you get it right, it's going to become more difficult. It's going to follow you along. If you get it wrong, it's going to become easier and go more to the basics. And at the end of a certain span of time, it is going to stop and tell you, this is where I think you are. This is how it compares with your own self-rating. And these are the learning resources in the market that your manager may have bought for you or have developed internally for you that are the most likely to help you accelerate your learning. This is the journey that you go through. The test is made of multiple choice questions, sometimes coding questions, sometimes open-ended questions or case studies. It may depend on what you're measuring, the order of thinking, the cognition that we're trying to measure.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm assuming that you have many finely grained tests to measure the skills that you cover, that Workera covers.
That is right. The reason you need to be hyper granular is because up to now, the way that organizations have looked at skills were highly broad. So for instance, an organization will consider Python, which is a programming language, to be a skill. When you go to an employee and you tell them, we think you have the Python skill because you had mentioned it on your resume and on HR data, is it going to be helpful for them? Likely not. It is not helping them in any way. So what we are doing is breaking down Python into the unit components, the orders of thinking, the tasks, the skills, so that you now have an entire domain of skills within Python and you can go to the employee and you say, I'm going to measure you, I'm going to give you feedback, I'm going to give you statistics, and that granularity will allow me to tell you which parts of Python you can focus on in order to grow your career. That same data is going to allow us to find the best projects for you, potentially find the best mentor or identify that you could be a great mentor in those seven skills within Python that some other teammates don't have. No.
Do you have a group of subject matter experts? I mean, how do you know what to measure for and what to ask?
Within the realm of skills measurements, we have two broad categories. We have what we call the public skill ontology and the private skill ontology. The reason we need public and private is because every organization is different. So a data scientist at Google versus Meta will have a lot of skills in common. Probably 70% of the skills are going to be in common, but also skills that are unique to each organization. 30% of it. A public ontology allows us to provide assessments that are market standards that are shared across the entire clientele. And those are built by experts that we work with directly. So there is an advisory board for an assessment that is responsible to update it as the domain changes. On the other hand, if you're working on a private ontology, the expert oftentimes comes from the company themselves. They have a subject matter expert in an area, and we work with that subject matter expert to translate their expertise into a rigorous skills measurement that can be then delivered to thousands of people within the organization.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Say a master on ontology that generally covers a domain, and then you have what you just described as private ontologies that are specific and confidential to a particular organization.
Exactly. And what it looks like from the worker's perspective is very interesting. You want your workers to have a clear idea of what they need to develop. Because up to now, we've been shooting in the dark. Workers have been taking 200-hour classes that they only needed to take 7 hours of. So it's very frustrating. It's a lot of time wasted. When you look as a worker, as your skill requirement on Workera, it is usually a combination of multiple cascaded requirements. An executive may be focused on the durable skills and may say, I have 7 domains that I believe are going to be so important for the future of the organization that I require it across 1,000 individuals. You go one level down at the manager level. Managers have a great sense of projects that are unique to the company. And so they're going to tag along with the durable skills with a set of maybe more perishable skills that they believe their workers are going to need for the next 6 months to a year. And that's going to add up to the skills requirements of the worker. On top of that, you go one more level down and you see that the worker has a great sense of what they need to learn for next week or in 2 weeks. I need to test myself on diffusion models because I have a project that will deal with it. I go on Workera, I quickly test myself on diffusion models and I understand my gaps. And so all in all, the worker will have skill requirements that are made up the executive level requirements, the managerial level requirements, and the self-directed requirements, which clarify what you need to develop.
We have a question from Twitter, again from Arsalan Khan, who says, it's about data. He says, typically data is the domain of data scientists and algorithms are the domain of computer scientists. Why can't we have non-technical business people involved in creating algorithms and collecting data for AI? So essentially, he's saying, can we have a kind of low-code, no-code approach for AI?
That is what I meant by maybe 5% of the organization are going to be builders of AI. And there's tons of technical skills within that that are required. Most people are going to be users of AI, but they will be able to use language models, to use computer vision algorithms in order to develop products with low-code platforms, no-code platforms. But still, they will require skills. Prompt engineering is an example of an important skill today for a business practitioner to be able to leverage AI and potentially develop a product for themselves. And so absolutely, that's what I meant by everybody will be an AI person, just at different levels of proficiencies.
And we have a question from LinkedIn, and this is from Jitendra Jamadar. And he says, what about M-shape and pie-shaped skills? Does the Workera model support that?
Absolutely. I will describe what it means for the audience. I was describing earlier the T-shaped career format with a set of durable skills and a set of perishable skills. There are other career formats that are very popular and are supported on Workera. The pie-shaped one is very similar to the T-shaped one. It is just that a worker may not have only one specialty of perishable skills. They may have two. You may be a sales practitioner that has all the foundational durable skills like negotiation, communication, persuasion, but you also have a specialty in Gen AI because you're working on selling a Gen AI product. And you also have a specialty in computer vision because you are selling autonomous cars and you need to describe what they look like. That's a pie-shaped career format. You also have something we call a comb shape, which again, you extrapolate the concept and you have multiple vertical bars of perishable skills. I do think that most people's career are going to evolve as a T-shape, as a comb shape, as a pie shape, because we will need durable and perishable skills to continue to innovate.
We have another interesting question now from LinkedIn, from Gus Bekdash, who says, some young people who were excited about Gen AI are reporting that it was a poor investment. There is a lot of excitement, but not enough jobs. AI is hard to monetize, but is Gen AI particularly susceptible to this?
Most companies are not good yet to identify use cases for AI and Gen AI. When we survey chief data officers at Workera, which we work with, we ask them, what are the use cases for AI? What are you hoping to get out of AI? What are the outcomes? There's tons of answers, but ultimately the answers fall under three meta groups. The first one is we're going to build products and we're going to build new solutions with AI. The second one is we're going to become more productive with AI. So I have tons of use cases on productivity. And the third one is I'm going to do all of that, but I'm going to do it responsibly. I'm going to mitigate risk. I'm going to increase security. And so all of these, you know, answers fall under those two groups. Now, more concretely, what I find happening in companies is that companies have been looking at Gen AI and they forgot about AI. But what they don't realize is that Gen AI has been really good at driving productivity, and there's already statistics showing it, and I think the workforce will become more productive. But the most of the value will come from AI, from use cases that are industrial use cases that are tied to subject matter expertise, and that may be different from Gen AI. I'll give you an example. I have a group of students a few years ago that come from an energy background, oil and gas, and they were working on predictive maintenance for a drilling system. So imagine you have a drill that goes 8 kilometers down the ground, and if the drill breaks, it's a huge business issue. Not only you lose very, very expensive materials, but you also fill in the hole and you cannot dig anymore in that hole. Well, here you go, you have an AI a problem that can be mitigated with AI, because AI can look at the data and tell you if the machine is going to break. That's predictive maintenance. And that is going to drive significant value for the organization. Now, going back to who is going to solve that problem, it is going to be an AI plus X individual. These folks understand the sensors on the machine. They understand the regulations. They understand where the model is going to be deployed. They understand who is monitoring the machine out there up the field. And those are questions that I don't understand, that a computer science student doesn't understand. And I think we just need to go beyond Gen AI and look at these practical industrial applications of AI that are going to drive significant outcomes.
We have another question from Twitter, and this is from Elizabeth Shaw, who says, how should organizations upskill their workforce in advance before people are displaced by AI, anticipating potential displacements in the future and hopefully trying to mitigate or prevent them?
Over the last 10 years, upskilling was content-led. So we have platforms that provide courses and podcasts and videos and books, and there's a ton of content out there. Managers will say, I have selected a course that is 200 hours, and post that course, there is a quiz that may validate someone has learned the video. And then after that, I'm going to find the projects for people. What happens is engagement is low because users, employees report that the course was just not relevant to their career. It may have been too easy. It may have been too hard. And thus, they haven't completed. But even for those who have completed, the manager cannot verify their skills because the quiz was aligned with the content. It was just verifying whether they watched the video or not. And the project is misaligned with the generic class that they were invited to do. And so we run into a ton of issues from an upskilling, time wasted, nothing to do after the course, nothing to apply your skills into. What's happening right now is that that approach, content-led, is being flipped, where content is actually the last step of the upskilling program. The way it's done in the foremost thinking organizations is you start with the projects. If you have projects, if you don't have identified projects, you start with the job architecture. How have you defined your job roles, your job families, your job levels? What are the skills involved in those? Can you incorporate your OKRs? That is the outcome. The outcome is then translated into a skill ontology, granular set of skills that are representative of what you want people to develop. That skill ontology is being verified with a verification system that is not meant to verify if someone has watched a video. It is meant to verify if someone has the skill on the job that you have defined in your ontology. And then only when you measure people on that ontology, you can talk about content and determine that Alice needs a 7-hour class, but Bob needs a 200-hour degree program. But Eve needs just to watch a video and read 2 research papers. And that is what's going to help us drive upskilling that is business-driven, not content-driven. And that is the big trend that we're seeing in the market at the moment.
We have a comment on LinkedIn, and this is from Bernadette Bohan. And she says, what are some of the key use cases that you are seeing? Can you give us some concrete examples here?
Use cases are going to fall under one of 3 categories: the products and solutions innovation, the productivity use cases, and the security and risk mitigation use cases. And I've seen plenty of these 3 categories. on the products and solutions innovation, I called out the use case about predictive maintenance on drilling. To give you another example, you know, I've seen medical students, medical practitioners work on X-ray imaging in order to determine if a patient has pneumonia or not. Again, here, the problem can be resolved to a certain extent with computer vision and AI, but who is going to solve that problem? The medical expert, because they understand the metrics that will be used to evaluate the model. They understand the deployment environment. They understand the clinical setting. They can show you in the clinical room in the Stanford Hospital which machine the model is going to be running on. All these things are uniquely requiring medical expertise. Another example that would come to mind is a group of people building a camera that you ingest via your mouth and that is meant to take pictures of your gastrointestinal journey and then will spit out certain predictions and certain pathologies that you may you may have. And those are, again, projects that require subject matter expertise and AI. There are plenty of these projects. On the risk and security mitigation, companies are worried that they will face data privacy issue, that some of the employees will leak data. And so what they're doing is get ahead of it. Employees are going to use it regardless of whether you ban it or not. We know that already, and we've seen it in multiple organizations. So what can you do? You can put together certain skills verification, certain certifications in order to make sure that people are aware of the risks of using artificial intelligence or not. So a lot of the use cases are risk mitigation and increasing security on that front.
Here's a question from Arsalan Khan, who says, AI might help to improve a process, but perhaps we still need holistic thinkers who can tell that the process itself is just wrong. Who is going to do this? The AI, the human, the business people, the technical people? In other words, who's got the overall view that we're actually headed in the right direction?
Absolutely. It is not the AI. It is the subject matter expert. That is why I think subject matter expertise is going to increase in importance in the coming years. You are working on an AI system. Who is going to stamp that AI system and say it works? The subject matter experts. Your AI deployment will be as good as the expertise that you have in the domain. A good company working on a great AI tool will have the expertise to say, this is how AI will be incorporated into the process. This is how the process needs to change. This is how we need to think about the business outcome. And so I don't think that subject matter expertise is going anywhere. If anything, I believe we will need more PhDs, we will need more domain experts, we will need people who know what they're doing in the subject matter that they're focused on.
Which raises another very interesting and important point, which is, what should business professionals do to retain their relevance as the great source of knowledge in the sky increases, namely the large language models that know everything?
There's tons of innovations ahead of us that we have not seen come to the world yet. It is just going to accelerate. If you can keep up with the pace, you will have a great career. You will contribute to the next generation of technologies that will be produced. You will solve certain use cases. But it is very important to have that mindset of lifelong learning. I think it's more important than ever. The other thing is the self-awareness. As more and more information comes to our world, we have to face critical decisions on how to spend our time. The best of us, the most self-aware, are going to be the ones who are going to spend their time on what matters the most, what matters to their company, what matters to their career, what matters to their project. And so make sure that you have created the right learning infrastructure around yourself to be self-aware. And that may come from different people or systems. Maybe you have a mentor or a coach that keeps you aware and tells you when you're doing something wrong or when you have a gap. Maybe you're using an assessment tool like Workera to take tests on a regular basis. I do that. And I took a test this weekend. I took it every week. And it helps me keep myself self-aware as much as possible. And So that's the point I'm making. Self-awareness and learning velocity, learning how to learn, these are going to be your career defensibility and your competitive advantage.
Self-awareness and learning defensibility, learning how to learn. These seem not so easy skills to diffuse through an organization.
It is a challenge. And I'll give you one thing that I've observed. The leaders we work with are great leaders, but generally, leaders would fall under two categories when it comes to upskilling. I have seen leaders, business leaders, pretend that they know AI. The problem when you pretend and you don't have self-awareness is the workforce tends to mimic the leader. So when someone pretends, everybody underneath is pretending. And that is when you end up with a workforce of dangerous amateurs that will take you on a journey to prototype AI. But when it's time to productize AI, you will fall short. On the other hand, you have leaders that are approaching upskillings with humility. The leaders take the worker assessments and they tell their team, listen, I'm not yet at the target score that I set for myself, but I'm not too far and I'm going to work on it and we're all in this together. The consequence of that is the workforce will mimic that behavior. The workforce will approach upskilling with humility. They will test themselves. They will take action on their gaps and they will try to reach their target score the same way their leader is trying to reach their target scores. And so I invite business practitioners to take the approach of humility rather than the approach of pretension.
Any final thoughts on the time frame for disruption that's likely to happen when it comes to workforces and just final advice on what businesses can do? And I'll also say to the audience, now is your last chance to get final questions in.
We're very focused on AI, and there is an AI hype cycle, and it is fine. As a business practitioner, don't shy away from learning AI. Just embrace the hype. The hype will die out, but you would have learned a ton of things while the hype was going. So embrace the hype. However, beware that as we're looking at AI, I believe the real frontier that is ahead of us is skills-based organization. It is a skills-based workforce. Because what's happening with AI is our world is accelerating. Technologies are coming out more frequently than ever. A few weeks ago, four major language models were launched in the same day from OpenAI and multiple competitors at the same time. Think about how fast that is. So the signal is the future moves fast. Learning velocity will be a new competitive advantage. And organizations who are going to understand their skills, take actions based on their skills, and become skills-based organizations are those who will be bulletproof to any hype that will come in the future and will continue to develop themselves. And so that is my my message to conclude on this question.
And with that, we are out of time. A huge thank you to Kian Khatanfarooj. Thank you so much, Kian, for being with us and sharing your expertise today.
Thank you, Michael, for having me. It was super fun.
And thank you to everybody who watched, and especially to those folks who asked such great questions. You guys are an amazing audience. Before you go, subscribe to our newsletter and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We do have incredible shows coming up. I always say that, you know it, and it's always true. We have great guests. So everybody, I hope you have a great day. Subscribe, stay in touch, and we'll see you soon. Have a great one, everybody. Bye-bye.